Hello. So yeah, tomorrow I will talk about spin forms, and today I will talk about this work I've done recently. So it's based on some old idea I had a few years ago with Florian, and now some work, most work done with Laurent, and some more recent work I've been doing with some Spanish guys, Enrique, Jacobo, and Iñaki. So what are we doing? So what I want to look at is the structure of SU2 intertwiners in loop quantum gravity. So intertwiners are particularly important since they are the elements of volumes in loop gravity. So the dynamics is going to act on them, and so on and so on. But we don't yet have a very good understanding of the geometric interpretations. So that's the main object of the talk. So the main tool that you're going to find, it's we're going to identify an action of UN on the space of intertwiners, and we're going to interpret them as array preserving diffeomorphism at the discrete level. So this UN will be the transformation that deforms the geometry of intertwiners, and we'll be able to see that in a concrete way. And then I'll show how to use this UN structure to count intertwiners and compare it to calculations of black hole entropy. I'll show that you can also use it to interpret the intertwiner space as an L2 space, or the quantization of some classical degrees of freedom. I'll introduce some creation and annihilation operators for these intertwiners, and show how to define coherent intertwiners, and show how all this can be used to do some kind of new reformulation of dynamics in loop quantum gravity. So it all started with an idea with Florian Girelli. So basically, we thought that SU2 is, you can write it in the Schwinger representation in terms of a couple of harmonic oscillators. Harmonic oscillators, we like them. It's very simple. So we thought there's something we could do with that. So more technically, so what we are looking at is the space of intertwiners with n leg. So invariant tensor under SU2. In the tensor product of n irreducible representations of SU2, so n different spins, j1 to jn. So the first step is to use these Schwinger representations and to write SU2 in terms of two harmonic oscillators, which I call A and Bs, which are the normal commutation relations. And then you can.
In space, or it's going to come in the.
Yeah, for a moment, there's just one SU2 representation. I get there. Slowly, I'll get there. Yeah, so you can write for generators of SU2 as quadratic operators in these harmonic oscillators. They form an SU2 algebra. Basically, the things to remember is that the total energy of these harmonic oscillators gives the spin. And the magnetic momentum in the usual SU2 basis is given by the difference of these energies. So that's the only thing to remember, really. So now, so that was one representation of SU2. Now what we want to take is, you want to take n representation of SU2. So you see this intertwiner there with n leg, and you usually interpret it thinking of a dual picture of it. So it's some kind of boundary surface around it, which represents some volume. And then each of these little edge is going to correspond to a patch of area on the surface of this boundary. And so you can, usually you like to view it as some kind of polyhedra, although it's just abstract picture. So basically, we're going to consider these intertwiners with n leg, and we're going to use this harmonic oscillators approach on them. So since we have n legs, we're going to take two n harmonic oscillators. So I just label them AIs and BIs. And since we are looking at intertwiners, we are interested in two invariant observables which commute with the global SU2 transformations, so that you will only get operators which act on the intertwiner space. So these global SU2 transformations act the same way by rotating all the punctures, all the representations, the n representations. So the usual operators that we consider in loop gravity that act on the intertwiner space is the scalar product operators. So which basically measure the angle between two area patch. So the J, J i's and J j's. So these operators are quartic of order 4 in the harmonic oscillators. So the problem here with these operators is that when you take the commutator of two of such operators, you're going to get a cubic operator. Usually we like that because it gives volume, and so you can study the volume operator and so on. But then you don't like it so much, because then if you keep taking the commutators of this volume with this product, scalar product operators, you're going to get higher order and higher order operators. And then if you want to build semi-classical states and you try to minimize some uncertainty relation, then it's not going to work. So it's bad. So here what we propose is that you can build some different operators which are still SU2 invariant, but that's going to form a closed algebra. So basically you take these very simple operators which act on a couple of links, A and J's, and they basically remove a spin 1/2 from the edge J and put it on the edge I. And what's cool is that these guys are quadratic into the harmonic oscillators, and so they're going to form a closed algebra, which is actually a closed UN algebra. So that's the UN we were looking for, that I talked about earlier. So what's the meaning of these operators? So if you look at the diagonal parts of them, then we give the total energy of the two harmonic oscillators that live on a given edge. So as I said earlier, that's the spin. Well, actually, it's twice the spin. And then if you look at the total, at the sum of all of these operators, which is actually the Casimir of a UN phase in UN, it gives twice the total area. And then all the other off-diagonal operators, the EIJs for E different from Js, are going to be raising and lowering operators in the UN algebra. So what to do with all that is that you've got these UN transformations that are going to act on the intertwiners. They're going to change each spin which lives on all the patches. They're going to change the intertwiners, but they're still going to commute with the UN Casimir, which is the total area. Which is why we decided to identify this UN as a group of error-preserving diffeomorphisms which act on this discrete boundary surface dual to the intertwiner. So here, the only point which I like to underline is that our definition of the area here, it's the sum of the spins, which is different from what is usually taken in loop quantum gravity, which is the sum of the square root of SU2 Casimir. So this definition is much simpler, but actually that's the one which works with this UN transformation. So if you want to interpret this UN transformation as area-preserving diffeomorphism, which we like, you need to take this as the area spectrum. The next question is that once we've got these operators, we need to, I've been talking about UN transformation, but we need to see these transformations. So which representation, what's the action of UN? Yeah?
So if you use the old-fashioned area operator, is that still embedded in the UN algebra somehow?
Well, there's the little square root. I guess you can construct it. Yeah, it's just that this UN is not going, no, it's, I mean, it's not going to be in this UN algebra, but you can construct it with using the harmonic oscillators. But then it will fluctuate with the UN transformations. So maybe it's interesting to look at that. But I haven't really, I've focused with this area spectrum, so I haven't looked at the other one.
What is your justification to call it an area?
Well, it looks like the sum of the spins, since it's the spin you identify with the area, or we call it the total area, which is almost like the usual Casimir, except there's just a little shift of 1/2 or 1/4, I don't remember. So it's almost the same, it's just some kind of quantization ambiguity. Actually, in loop quantum gravity, you can construct this area operator, and it's consistent, just not the one that most people like. Although, since it's much simpler, we should like it better. No?
And why people don't like it?
You like the square root of the SU2 Casimir, and so on.
We can discuss that. There is an issue of now the spectrum is equally spaced.
Yeah, there's some issues like that, but it's unclear for me. So I was going to talk about the UN representations that we get. So because you'd like to know which representation of U n is going to live in the intertwiner space, so it will provide some explanation, some understanding of the structure of the intertwiner space. So all that to say that actually constructing a U n algebra using harmonic oscillators, it's actually, we found out it was a standard construction in math. So if you take P sets of n harmonic oscillators, so I put the P label upstairs and the other label downstairs, then if you sum over all these P sets of these couple operators which act on pairs of indices, then they always form a UN algebra. So if you take P equal to 1, basically you have only one set of n harmonic oscillators, and this is going to give you highest weight representations which are totally symmetric, which are represented by Young tableau with a single horizontal line. And then if you take P sets, you're going to tensor this representation P times. So you're going to get Young tableaus which have P horizontal lines. The case that interests us is P equal to 2. The case that actually they look in mathematics, it's P equal to N, because then we get some kind of duality of UN cross UN, and we do cool things on invariance of UN. So for those who are interested, it allows to give a recursion relation of the SIGG symbols for UN, so if anybody is interested in that. So I can show that more explicitly. So for P equal to 1, you use the definitions of the EIJs in terms of the harmonic oscillators, and you get this kind of constraint on the generators, which basically relates for SUN Casimir and the U1 Casimir, which is the area, and well, N. And you solve these kind of equations by having them act on the highest weight of your representations. So a vector which diagonalizes all the diagonal operators, the EIs, and that vanishes on all raising operators. So you put that in there, and you solve it, and you find that basically all the eigenvalues are 0 but 1. So that corresponds to the representation with a single line in the Young tableau that I talked before. Then for P equal to 2, which is the case we like, we do the same trick, and we find something that relates the SUN Casimir, the UN Casimir, and the SU2 Casimir. Now we can act it on the highest weight, and we're going to find that all the eigenvalues are equal, are 0, except for 2, L1 and the first 2. And in fact, since you're interested in the intertwiner space, you want this SU2 Casimir to be trivial. And what it's going to mean is that these two eigenvalues are actually equal. So we just found that the intertwiner space defines a representation of UN, which is defined by the highest weight with two non-trivial eigenvalues which are equal. So and in that case, it corresponds to states with a total area which is given by this eigenvalue, since these eigenvalues are actually twice the spin, if you remember. So okay, we got some nice mathematical result. Now what's the meaning of this state? So since I said that these eigenvalues are the spin, so this should correspond to a bivalent intertwiner. So you've got only two edges which carry non-trivial spin, and all the other spins are 0. So it's kind of an invalent intertwiner where only two representations are non-trivial. So you can interpret it from the point of view of a boundary surface as just a surface with two big patches, or some like some sphere which is completely squashed. And then you're going to act with a UN transformation, and you're going to generate all possible invalent intertwiners with non-trivial spins on every edge. Then the first thing you can compute, the dimension of these representations using the standard Hooke formula for SUN representations, and you write it in terms of binomial coefficients, so something very simple. So what we got up to now is that this UN act on the space of intertwiners at fixed total area, L, and fixed number of punctures, N, and this includes the possibility of having trivial spins on the edges. And then the dimension of this representation actually gives the number of all such intertwiners. Clack. So just to insist on that point, what we just found is that the dimension of the UN representation is equal to the sum of all the dimensions of the intertwined spaces, as long as the sum of the spins is fixed to that parameter L, which is the total area. So then we can, to check that everything is consistent and we didn't do any mistake, we can check this equality directly. And actually, it's pretty enlightening. So you do that by introducing the corresponding generating functional by summing over the areas with some parameter t. So I call it f for the dimension of the UN representation and f tilde for the dimension of the SU2 intertwined space. So the usual way to compute f tilde of the dimension of the intertwined space here is to write it as an integral of the SU2. So you write it here, the integral of SU2 of this series in terms of the SU2 characters. And then you can write it as a trigonometric integral. So now the thing that happens is that you can show that these two generating functional are going to satisfy the same second order differential equation with this differential operator being this, I don't know if it's beautiful, this kind of operator. Well, it's there. So how do you do that? I mean, first, since the dimension of the UN representations is given in terms of binomial coefficients, it's pretty easy to write a recursion relation on them. So this very simple relations, and using that, you transform it into a differential equation on the generating functional. And then you can check that this operator acting on the other generating functional is going to vanish. So that was an integral, so you act on it, it gives this, you do some little integration by part, and you just found that it's zero. So at the end, you just showed that these two generating functional satisfy the same differential equation. You can check that it's the same values for the initial points, and so they are equal. And then you can also use this differential equation to find out this, to compute that generating functional. And you can show it's some pretty ugly expression in terms of the derivatives of the Lorentz polynomials. Ugly, but it's explicit. And then since we like generating functional, we can actually sum over everything and compute the big generating functional, where you sum both over the areas and the number of punctures. And it turns out you can compute it exactly, this algebraic thing. So this function contains the whole structure of the dimension of the intertwined space for loop gravity. It's kind of cool. So using the generic functional, for example, by looking at the pole structure, you can get the asymptotics of this kind of series. So I sum over all the number of punctures of the dimension of the UN representation for fixed area with a parameter u to the power n. And I take the log, because later I will talk about entropy. And this behaves holographically in terms of the area. So I just put it there because I will use it later when I talk about black hole entropy. The only thing to notice here is that if I was simply summing the number of punctures of these dimensions, so setting u equal to 1, it would diverge. So that's a point that will come back later. This is just for people who like details, that for the moment I've only discussed about the dimension of the intertwined space of the UN representations, but you can go further in looking at characters of the UN, in this UN representations, so functions of group elements. I'm not going to go into that, but just to say that these characters allow to distinguish between the different spins. So before I was only summing about some parameter t to the power of the total area, and now I can actually probe deeper the structure of intertwined space by distinguishing the value of the spins of the individual edges. Again, we can compute all that explicitly, and it's given by some Vandermeer determinant. It's cool. But actually where I want to get, it's to discuss about black hole entropy, because we computed the dimension of this intertwined space, and yes, it does look like the black hole entropy calculations. So yes, so the dimension of this UN representation counts the number of SU2 intertwiners. But But so the usual loop quantum gravity calculations with the isolated horizon actually count U1 intertwiners. But there have been a series of work, recent or less recent, which have been arguing that instead of U1, you should consider the SU2 structure and count SU2 intertwiners. So then, OK, I say, OK, we're going to count SU2 intertwiners because that's what I know how to do. The other problem is that the total area is the sum of the JIs, whereas usually in the black hole entropy calculation, they compute it using the standard area spectrum. But also recently, there's people who've been computing the black hole entropy using this spectrum, and they found cool results. But our justification is actually this is the area which is preserved by these U1 transformations. So it's very natural to consider that this is the total area of the boundary. So these are little issues, but we just keep them in mind. Now we have bigger problem is that actually in these intertwiners, we are counting many intertwiners which carry trivial representations. So in loop quantum gravity, usually if you have a spin zero and an edge, you like to say that there's no edge. So you shouldn't count that. So the natural thing that we would like to do is remove all these possibilities of having a trivial spin on the edges. And actually related to the following issue is that the dimension that we're computing here is a function of the total area and a function of the total number of punctures. But usually the black hole entropy is only a function of the total area, so we have one parameter too many. So we had to get rid of this n. So here we've got two possibilities. Either we argue that n is a parameter, and that somehow if I am actually looking at a black hole in loop quantum gravity, this n should be fixed in terms of the outside geometry, and since the outside geometry sees a black hole, this n should be fixed in terms of the total area. It's one possibility, which also takes in account that somehow you don't really care about counting trivial spins there, because usually on one edge, there will be a superposition of different spins. So if one edge has a superposition of a spin zero and a spin one, am I keeping it, removing it? I mean, it's kind of an unclear question. So in this kind of proposal, you just forget, sidestep this problem. Obviously, the most natural proposal, which is simply you want to get rid of n, so you just sum over it. But as I just said earlier, if you just sum over n, then it diverge. But actually diverge because you've been counting trivial legs, trivial possibilities. So in order to sum over n's, you need to remove all the trivial representations, and then you'll get some magically some finite number. So first I will talk about the first possibility. So basically, what happens is you fix n as a function of the total area. And you find that there's only one interesting limit regime, which is the linear regime. This is when the number of punctures is going to scale linearly with the total area. This is the only regime in which you get a holographic behavior for the entropy, so the log of the dimension of the UN representations. So you get this formula, which a leading order proportional to the area, and a proportionality factor, which is related to the ratio between the number of punctures and the area. So the thing that I like about that is that this is an extra parameter that you could fine-tune to get the right ratio between the entropy and the area without touching the emisive parameter. So it's an impossibility to keep in mind.
So then, is there an operation on this parameter?
Well, to get a physical interpretation, you would require understanding why you should fix the number of punctures in terms of the area. But here it's just an intertwiner, so I didn't care about what's outside of the dynamics. If you want a physical interpretation, you would have to care about what's outside.
So an argument that sometimes needs to be made is that you should consider what distribution of spins per puncture for a given area gives the most entropy. So that would be the same thing as maximizing entropy with respect to your lambda. And my guess is at least what the answers used to be the field areas is that it was maximized, and it was maximized with minimal lambda, as with lambda of 1/2, in 1/2 on each function. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's still the case, but you previewed it on.
Well, yeah, maybe, but I mean, that's a calculation that is doable, so check it out. I didn't think about that. Well, I mainly focus on the other possibility here, which is removing the trigger parameters. So.
And do I understand right that the reason why there's a divergence is not just that there's the trivial punctures, but the issue is that if you're summing over n, and for each n there are all the possible trivial punctures, you're doing a lot of multiple counting in the same space.
Yes. Yes. So for example, if you take a n minus 1 valent intertwiner and you just add zeros, then you can add the zero n different ways, and so on and so on. But now if you sum over n's, then you're counting this n minus 1 valent intertwiner, and you're counting all its n copies, which are n valent, and so on and so on. So you're counting a lot of times the same intertwiner. Yeah. So if n is not a physical quantity, then you're doing really other counting.
Right. So you can eliminate
that? That's what I'm going to show. And so
basically what you must keep in mind is that if you look at the dimension of the intertwiner space between n representations of spin J1 to Jn, this only depends on the occurrence number of each spin. So I count the number of spins by the spin 0, which I call K0, spin 1, half, K1 half, and so on. And this doesn't, and that depends only on these occurrence numbers for non-trivial representations. So yeah, here I just said that the constraints are that the total numbers, the sum of all these occurrence numbers, it's n.
The number of times that a spin j appears in this list. Mm. So I look how many times I have put a representation 0, representation 1, half 1, and so on and so on. And now, as I said, the dimension of the UN representation is the sum of the dimension of the intertwiner space as long as the sum of the spins is fixed to the total area, which is, in terms of the case, which is these two constraints here. So now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to rewrite that in terms of the dimension of intertwiner space, but labeled only by these occurrence numbers, which is a natural thing because the dimension of intertwiner space only depends on them. And you see that basically here I separate the number of trivial punctures, which is k, non-trivial punctures. K is the number of non-trivial punctures. And I define here the number of intertwiners of area L, but without trivial punctures. And this is just a statistical weight, which corresponds to how many, all the ways I can add k trivial punctures to my intertwiner. Then this dk is related like that to the dimension of intertwiner spaces. So now what I want to do is compute this new dimension. So once I would have computed that, I could actually sum over all the number of non-trivial punctures and get the total number of intertwiners at fixed area without trivial puncture. And from this one, I hope to get the right entropy formula. So a priori, this sum is infinite. But since the smallest spin is 1/2, it truncates this sum. So this is a finite sum with the number of non-trivial punctures being bounded by twice the area. So now to compute that, I mean, just before I've given this formula of the dimension of the UN presentation in terms of these dimensions, you can invert that. And it's what people usually call the binomial transform. It often appears when you do differential calculus on a discrete space. What's cool about this binomial transform is that you can have an easy relation between the old generating functional for dim of the UN representations and the new dimensions without trivial punctures. So these ones, I will call them G. And so, as I said, there's a simple relation between the new generating functional and the old one. And this allows you to compute this dimension, the total number of non-trivial intertwiners for fixed area L. This is actually correspond to
the summing of all n's of a dimension of a UN representation, but with just this 1 over 2 to the power n factor. So this simple factor allows to kill all the other counting. And then using the formula for the generating functional, you can actually compute the log of this dimension and check that it's properly linear in the area with a logarithmic correction, which is minus 3 to the 3.5, which is the usual correction that you get when you count SU2 intertwiners. And so that's the expected results.
I don't know how to compute log in my head.
No,
it's a random number. Anybody see the log of 6 plus 4 square root of 2 before? Once again, you can go into calculation and enjoy it and have fun. You can compute the geometric functional for the summing of all total areas. And then it's this simple function, which you can use, you can write, you can find that it's satisfying the first order differential equation, which is this one, which translates into some recursion relation between these dimensions. So second order recursion relations. So if you wanted to compute exactly these dimensions, you put them on a computer and it's
really fast using this recursion relation. You don't need to go through summing all intertwiner spaces and all that. So yes, so that was about black hole entropy. So now we'll skip to the second point. Yeah?
So before you leave black hole entropy, let me just query. So the UN representation you're seeing is area preserving diffeomorphisms which act on these states and take you amongst them. These are the states that you're counting for entropy. You might think that there's a subgroup of these UN transformations which implements global SO3 rotations, which are rotating the black hole.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you identify them? They are a subgroup of the area preserving.
No, I haven't yet. But yeah, it should be there.
It should.
Yeah. Probably we can do that using the coherent intertwiners that we will introduce later.
Okay, so let's talk about that energy.
That's an interesting point. So the second thing is that but we can see the space of intertwiners with n leg as a space of L2 functions over some manifold. So basically, if I look at the Hilbert space of n valent intertwiners, which is the direct sum on all possible spins of an intertwiner space between these n spins. Actually, we just showed that this is the sum, the direct sum of all possible areas of these UN representations. And since it's UN representations, you can actually see that using the Peter-Walt theorem, that this is just the L2 space over the UN group, but with this Gauge invariants, which are invariant under the action of U n minus 2 cross SU2. So this U n, it's natural to see where it comes from. The question is like, when is this subgroup natural? It's actually the subgroup that stabilizes the highest weight vector.
So as I said, if you remember the highest weight vector, it was something that was diagonalizing, which had two non-trivial eigenvalues and then n minus 2 values to 0. So it's natural to see that it's invariant to the SU2 and U and minus 2. So that's the subgroup. The Grassmannian space, it's different like that. It's a quotient of... It's this kind of quotient. So as I said, the space of L2 functions over that space are functions on UN, which satisfies this invariance. And then what you can do is that you can give an interpretation of this space as a space of a geometric interpretation as the space of polyhedras with n faces and only trivial n vertices. So basically, this gives an understanding of like what's this classical space which is behind the intertwiner space. So which is space of classical polyhedras, and then you look at wave functions on that, and that's the intertwiner space. No, I can't draw it.
Yes, no, we're not so interested by doing that. But I mean, basically, for any one to force a tetrahedron, and then if you want to get like extra faces, you just do moves like one free moves, or transform one point into some a triangle, and so on and so on. And so you will get something which at the end would have n faces with this number of edges and vertices. And you can check that the dimension of these two spaces match.
What is the meaning of that you went to them?
It's one face per triangle which corresponds somehow at the rotation, but it's quantum level. So this is classical, and this is like more something corresponding to the area of some invariants. Yeah. I was not so interested in getting more details on the classical interpretation of that. I wanted more to move on to like talking about spin networks. Because
can I interpret the polyhedra you're talking about like a tetrahedron from which I start cutting the corners?
Yes, I said. Yeah, you take a tetrahedron, you take one point and you do a one free move. So splitting into a point into a face.
Can you draw?
I'm not sure what drawing you want. This is going to that, and that was one corner of your tetrahedron, and you just put into a triangle, and then you do that and that over and over again. But I'm sorry to have put on the light just for that. I tried all of them. Yeah, cool. So yeah, no, I didn't want to insist too much on that polyhedra thing. I wanted to move more to spin networks. So spin networks is really what we consider in loop gravity. So you take a given graph gamma, and you look at all functions of E group elements on that, which satisfies gauge invariants at each vertex. So these are wave functions, which are in L2 of E copies of SU2 quotiented by V copies of SU2. Well, of course, E is the number of edges and V is the number of vertices. So this satisfies this gauge invariants. Now, what interests me is that this construction with the UN, it actually allows to shift the perspective from the edges to the vertices. That basically before, you have that the degrees of freedom are holonomies on the edges, and that the gauge invariance is at the vertices. Now what you do is exactly the opposite. You will find that the degrees of freedom are on the vertices, and the edges are just what's gluing them. So if I take this Hilbert space of spin networks on gamma, you write it as naturally as the sum of all spins on the edges of a tensor product of the intertwiner space associated to each vertex. And then this Hilbert space, you see that it's just the L2 functions over this Grassmannian space manifold that I introduced earlier. And then these are the gluing conditions. You've got one gluing condition for each edge, which is just saying that the spin on this edge seen from the source vertex is equal to the spin seen by the target vertex. So just ensuring the same representation living on the same edge. And so, well, you can write all these functions as functions on UN, on V copies of UN, with having the invariants under the SU2 cross U and minus one group here, and then all the different invariants under the U one on each edge.
So,
the valence of each, the NVs of the valence of each node?
Yes.
So basically, we've known for a long time that if you have four valent nodes, you could represent them as tetrahedra and think of in a dual picture once you glue the tetrahedra together.
Yes.
Now you're saying, using this UN algebra in the background, you can generalize that to a picture in which for any valent nodes, the node is represented by a space of possible polyhedra glued together on
Basis. So basically, these are going to be wave functions on the space of glued polyhedras,
of glued classical polyhedras.
Now, something that with your picture filling on the polyhedra from the tetrahedra by the 1 to 3 moves is there. This is where it's going to be useful. Not all the faces are the same in your polyhedra. Some are triangles, some are hexagons, and so forth.
Yes.
So how do you know when I have two nodes which share an edge, and that's dual to a face here and a face here, that the faces are the same polyhedra? Because how come you don't sometimes have to glue a triangle to a hexagon or a pentagon or something like that?
Yeah, but details from the polyhedra interpretation rule seems to be worked out. That's something I don't know the answer to, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, for a moment, I've mainly been working on and stopped here. So yeah, so now that we've done that, I mean, what is it called? Okay, this, if we learn more about this polyhedral interpretation, it would be a very clear geometric interpretation for this finite functional, but I see it, there's also other interesting things about it. That first, you've just shifted the degrees of freedom on the vertices. So then it means you can reformulate the loop gravity dynamics as acting directly on the intertwiner space, which is much more convenient when you want to have local dynamics and so that. So it's just a shift on where are the degrees of freedom. And then you, as I said, you can also see that the intertwiner space is as L2 space of wave function on a classical unitary matrix. So basically it means that you can describe a unitary intertwiner dynamics as a matrix model. So that's work and what's going to come out very soon, but I've done with some Spanish guys in Penn State and in Erlangen.
And it's kind of funny because we know a lot of things on matrix models, so it means we're going to be able to say a lot of things on the intertwiner, dynamics of intertwiners. So, but, yeah. So the next step that I want to say, that now that you've got all this intertwiner space, you'd like to have like operators which allow like to create intertwiners, annihilate them, and so on, to basically go from one intertwiner to the other. And this is done by introducing some new set of SU2 invariant operators, which this time are going to involve only annihilation operators for the harmonic oscillators, or if you take the dagger, only creation operators. So once again, we're going to act on a couple of edges, so I's and J's. But this time, instead of taking one spin from one and putting it on the other, it's just going to remove spins from both edges, or create spins, add the spin one half to these two edges. So these are operators which are still invariant of the SU2, so they still act in the intertwiner spaces, but we do not preserve the total area, since we're going to change the total area by +1 or -1. So this is just given by this commutation relation, where you can explicitly see that F is an annihilation operator and F dagger is a creation operator. Then you can write the full algebra of the E's and F, and you can find that it's a closed algebra, where basically E with F or F dagger is going to give F and F dagger, but also the commutator of F with F dagger is going to give back the operators E's that we have before. So actually this construction is interesting because you can use it explicitly, since you see that, to use the F daggers to build coherent states for the intertwiners by acting on the vacuum state. So, as I said, we want to use this to construct coherent intertwiners. So what do we want? What would we call coherent intertwiners? the first criteria is that we want a basis of intertwiners that transform consistently under UN transformations. So it means you're going to have this one coherent state, you act with UN, and you want to have another coherent state. So wave packets, we do not change shape under UN. So under error-preserving diffeomorphisms. Of course, we'd also like that it's some semi-classical intertwiners with some bigness properties. That means that it's approximate some semi-classical, some classical geometric configurations. And then one other thing that we like is that it's a relation between these intertwiners and the usual coherent or holomorphic intertwiners that have been introduced recently by me, Simone, Laurent, and Florian. And actually, if you show that there's such relation, it will actually directly show that it is that these intertwiners are semi-classical, because we know a lot about these coherent and holomorphic intertwiners, that they have all the nice properties, semi-classical properties. But more interestingly, it will provide some geometric interpretation for UN transformations, because you would have intertwiners which represent some semi-classical, some classical geometric configuration. You act with UN and you find a different classical configurations, so you would understand exactly what this UN means. Clack. So actually, to do that, I'm going to go back a lot. So to each, if you take this boundary, you have these n patches, and now you want to build something semi-classical, you're going to describe each patch by its the normal vector to it, which I call n here. So n is going to give a direction, and its norm is going to give the area of the patch. So this is a free vector, and you can see it as a, you can write it in terms of a spinner. So two convex numbers up to a global phase. So if I take a spinner like that, you can see that if you take the matrix of the spinner with its trace, the trace of the spinner, it has a identity component which is given by the norm of that vector, and then its projection on the Pauli matrices defines this free vector again. So this is just simple algebra. Then what's interesting is that you can translate the closure constraint very easily. So the closure constraint is that the sum of the normals on all the patches are zero, which means it's a closed polyhedra. So using this formula, you clearly see that if you sum over all the i's in this formula, it's going to kill this term. So it means that the sum of all these matrices corresponding to every spinner is purely proportional to the identity. And the proportional constant is the area, well, up to a factor 1/2. So why am I saying that? Is that now you can use this Z to construct coherent intertwiners. So you're going to build this little matrix there, which takes into account all these spinners. And from this matrix, you're going to contract it with the Fij's operators, well, Fij's dagger. Then you're going to act with it J times. So J is actually simply going to give the total area of my state. Because each time I act with an F dagger, it's going to create an area 1, and so on and so on. And then all the directions of that is going to be contained in this matrix. So what's cool about these states is that you can show that they behave consistently in the UN transformations. Meaning if I act on the UN on that state, J, Z, so this coherent state, it's just going to act on the labels for that state. So you're happy. So now, of course, you cannot ask me, like, since the Z represents the directions, and you know the action of UN on the Zs, does it have a nice geometric interpretation? And this is a kind of unclear question. I don't have a clear answer to that. These are actually pretty weird transformations. But anyway, meaning that they behave consistently in the UN transformation, it means that these states cover the intertwiner space, and you can write a resolution of the identity and all that. What's also interesting is that you can compute the expectation values. So for example, the expectation values of EKL, which supposedly represents, managed to give you the scalar product between states. And when you compute that, you find that it just gives you the scalar product between the directions of two edges, so the JZ and JL. And then you try to understand like this matrix, what it actually represents. And you can show that it's a rank 2 projector with eigenvalues, with only two non-trivial eigenvalues, which are equal. And somehow that reminds you of like what you did with the highest weight. And you realize that this semi-classical expectation, this classical expectation value corresponds exactly to what you would expect from the choice of the UN representations that we took. So all that to say that basically we have the right expectation value that we want from that state. Then to understand that these are really semi-classical, you can actually show that they are related to the standard coherent detwiners. So the standard coherent detwiners is taking coherent states for SU2 on each patch and group averaging them to get an detwiner. And then these new coherent states, they are just the sum of all these coherent states with some statistical weight, such that the sum of all the spins is equal to the total area that I fixed. Yes. So once you arrive there, you're kind of happy. You really characterize these coherent states mathematically. Then the next step would be to understand really the geometry of them and how the UN representation, the UN transformation act on them. But what I want to get is use all this formalism for something else. It's to have a look, another look at the dynamics for loop gravity. So we are going to look at the simplest possible setting, so graphs which are bivalent. So two vertices which are linked with n links. And this is just a generalization of a work, very recent work by Rovelli and Vidotto. But they do the same thing, but with only four edges between the two vertex. And they write the dynamics, the loop gravity dynamics on that, and they show it's related to cosmology with some a little bit of inhomogeneities, as they say. So, I mean, this kind of model have direct interpretations and can be useful, not only to understand the dynamics of quantum gravity, but can have cosmological implications. But I'm not there yet. Much more basic is that. So what happens with that is that you have two independent intertwiner space for these two points, alpha and beta, and they are related by the matching constraint, meaning that there's the same spin on each edge seen from alpha or from beta. This is exactly the matching condition I talked about earlier. And basically, these are given by saying that the total energy of intertwiners on an edge I, but seen from alpha, is equal to the same energy for beta. And what you can actually see that these matching conditions are only the diagonal part of a larger UN algebra, which is obtained by combining the UN algebra for intertwiners alpha and intertwiner beta. These operators still form a UN algebra. So basically here you can just notice something is that this is the EJI is actually the dagger of E of IJ. So basically what these operators see is that they see a deformation of the boundary from the point of view of alpha, and from the point of view of beta you see exactly the opposite transformation, which is what you would expect since one is inside, one outside, so we see opposite things. So then what we looked at, what I'm interested in, is that I'd like to find operators which satisfy these matching conditions. So some dynamics which would act really on my spin network state. So the natural operators that I find, it's operators which act the same ways on alpha and beta, using the E's or using the F. So I can act with these E alpha IJs, E beta IJs, and they increase the spin on the edges I's by 1/2 and decrease the spin on J by 1/2. And then I've got these other operators, FF, which decreases both spin, or F dagger, which increases both spins. So then you can introduce operators which have a sum of all pairs of edges, so all loops in your spin network. And of course, here I forgot the sum of IJs. And what's cool about these operators is that they're invariant under the UN deformation algebra. So in some sense, you could call them diffeomorphic invariant if you, well, I like to call them like that. So, and actually, they are the only operators which are quadratic, which are invariant under UN and non-trivial. And then a simple ansatz for Hamiltonian would be something like that. So acting with this is plus some Hermitian combinations of the FF and F dagger F dagger. Actually, if you take such a Hamiltonian, it corresponds to it generalizes the action of a one half holonomy operator, so which corresponds to the dynamics of BF. So not gravity, just BF. Meaning, but simply the one half holonomy operator is going to act as a special combination of decreasing spins, increasing, or decreasing both spins on both edges. So this corresponds to a certain choice of alpha and sigma. I don't remember it's a ratio of 1 or 2, but well, it's very simple. Yeah. So certain remarks about this choice, this kind of ansatz that we choose. I mean, first, we can give some cool meaning to this F dagger operator. So if I act with this F dagger, J times on the vacuum state, so I will get a state which has a total area J. And so what I did is that each time I act on a random pair of edges, adding one half and one half to them. And then what you can find, what you can show using the UN structure, that if you trace out on the outside vertex for beta, then you get the totally mixed state on the system alpha. So somehow it's a pure state that you get by acting on the vacuum state, which creates a situations where these two intertwiners are totally entangled, and if you trace on that, then you get totally mixed state on the other one, meaning that, for example, if I look at the entropy of that mixed state, it's going to be the log of the dimension of intertwiner space, which I know corresponds to the black hole entropy, if I'm very optimistic. So somehow we call that the black hole creation operator. And if I now act with my Hamiltonian, I mean, F dagger is in it, so it's going, there's a non-trivial probability of getting such configurations. But also, and since I've got this kind of black hole configurations, now I could take a look at the action of my Hamiltonian or Hamiltonian constraint on such a state. And well, if I'm very optimistic, I would like to see evaporation or something like that. Very optimistic here. Yeah.
What you can.
Well, it's basically
a surface with a certain area.
Yeah, well, I know it's just a graph, an equivalent graph. But what I want to say is that basically beta doesn't know if it's going to, once we're outside, you don't know anything of what's happening inside. Because the density matrix for inside is the identity. So you don't know the state inside. So it looks like a black hole configuration to me. So the Hamiltonian that I looked before was the simplest answer that I could find. Now, if I want something which looks more like the Hamiltonian constraint of loop gravity, so it acts with a holonomy with some double graspings on the graph, it would correspond to something more of this type. And it's pretty easy to see that it's not UN invariant, which actually asks two questions. Like, first, there's a question of if it's not invariant of the UN, under which deformations of a boundary it is invariant, can I find a subgroup of UN which leaves it invariant? It's something I don't know. The other question is, like, is there quadratic operators or like more generic operators which are invariant to the UN, others than the one I already gave, which are just quadratic, and that I don't know either. But all that, what I want to say is that by taking this Hamiltonian before, that's what I wrote in the previous page, this thing, I mean, you can study it and look at the evolution of this H, and you would get some simple model to test some new way to write the dynamics of gravity in terms of these UN operators. So, yeah.
So I want to conclude by summarizing a bit what I showed, is that there's a natural UN action on the space emitted twiness for a fixed number of legs in fixed area. And we interpret this UN as the area preserving the morphism of the boundary surface dual to the intertwiner. This led us to compute the dimension of the UN representations, which takes into account trivial punctures or the dimensions without trivial punctures. And we recovered the entropy formula of holographic, which correspond to black holes usually. We also define UN coherent states and relate them to the usual coherent intertwiners, which is cool. Although there's still some work to be done here about the geometric interpretation. And I also showed how I would like to use this framework to discuss the dynamics for quantum gravity. So some other points I'd like to mention is that this procedure, we made it work for SU2, for quantum gravity, but it works for any unitary group, any quantum deformations, and any supersymmetric group. So you could use it for other gauge theories, or you can use it using the quantum deformation. You can apply it when there's a cosmological constant and so on. Now things that I would like to see when to do later is to look a bit more at the refinement limit when the number of intertwiners, the number of punctures goes to infinity, and really relate this UN to diffeomorphism in the continuum. I think that would be very useful. But other things which I'd like to look at is the dynamics of horizons and also more generally just surfaces, because it's not necessarily horizons, it's just surface. Look at this dynamics from point of view of matrix models, and especially when you look when you think of the black hole calculations in loop gravity, but you can see it's somehow related to some trans-Simon theory, which is related to some quantum Hall effect, which is related to matrix models. So there's so many things there. I would just like to put them together, and seems to be a promising approach. But I'd like to solve this dipolar cosmological model that I just introduced, that generalizes the work by Carlo and Francesca. And actually, I would like to generalize it to some more complicated, to arbitrary graphs, to be able to give really a reformulation of the whole dynamics of loop gravity in terms of these UN structures. And finally, since we've got these UN coherent states constructed, and we already used a lot of the coherent intertwiners in spin four models, the natural question is, this new coherent state, I guess they would be very useful in spin four models. So that's all I have to say.
I have two questions about the interpretation of alpha. So in the picture where this is a surface, how far can you push this holographic idea? That is, could you imagine that the surface is a surface on which one is making observations, and one doesn't know any, one is unable to make any observations in the center? And could you push the idea that the boundary of the observable algebra U n that you have is the natural algebra for observables on such a surface, full stop?
Yeah, I like this interpretation. I definitely like it.
Yeah, the different operators that you could measure outside, if you don't know what's happening inside. Yeah.
Right, so then is there a way you can, I mean, the appearance of UN is very telling. Is there a way you can somehow push this to the ABS-CFT picture? Or is there a way with this UN and that UN gauge theory limited that equals infinity somehow? Can you talk to that?
Oh, that's pushing it even further than what I already tried to. So, yeah, maybe. I mean, I know this UN in the structure is very useful when you look at the infinity limit. That's why I was so happy of finding UN here. Then I'm not sure, I haven't gone much further than what I said here.
I mean, there's the one place the ABS-CFT came from was thinking about the area preserving the dynamics of a membrane, mm-hmm. thinking about the area preserving diffeomorphisms morally as some limit of UN. And so, is there a way in which supposing you tried to describe the dynamics of the surface, you could make contact with that picture?
Well, it would be a nice motivation to write some sort of dynamics on that space of intertwiners, because for the moment the space of intertwiners is kinematic also. I don't know. I mean, it looks interesting. I mean, kind of thing. Wouldn't mind trying, but yeah, I don't know.
Any other questions?
I haven't done yet, but I don't want to give you a person asking questions.
Okay, then we can finish here. Thank you.